Good evening. Welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here Monday evenings between 8 and 10 p.m. Glad you could be here with us on listener-sponsored WPKN Radio. That's WPKN.org. And we have a very special program to bring you this evening. And it's in the context of recent events, but more importantly, on the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And we are going to talk about economics. We're going to talk about labor unions. We're going to talk about violence and a lot of things that Dr. King dedicated his life to, for, and against. And I want to just run down who we're going to be talking with tonight. Our first guest is William Grider, and we're going to be talking about a recent article he wrote titled The End of New Deal Liberalism. We'll also speak tonight with Chip Verlet of Political Research Associates, who has long followed movements on the right, violence, and the things that contribute to that violence and hate. A little later tonight, we'll speak with Josh Sugarman, founder of Violence Policy Center, and we're going to be talking about the gun rights movement in this country and its connections with right-wing violence. And later this evening, we're going to speak with Mark Brenner of the publication Labor Notes. So we're going to be talking about public employees unions and the current attacks on public employees. It should be noted, of course, many of you already know that Dr. Martin Luther King, when he was killed in Memphis, he was marching in solidarity with the public employees unions in that city down south. So with that said, I thank you all for being here tonight. Again, this is a special show on some of the principles and issues that Dr. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to. And we welcome first to the program this evening William Grider, National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation magazine, who previously was Rolling Stone magazine's National Affairs Editor and Assistant Managing Editor at The Washington Post. William Grider's widely acclaimed books include One World Ready or Not, Secrets of the Temple, and Who Will Tell the People. His latest book is titled Come Home America, The Rise and Fall in Redeeming Promise of Our Country. William Grider, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Yeah.
Well, we got you on the air now. Okay, thank you. William Grider, on the day when we celebrate the life and work of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we're very happy to have you here to discuss your recent article titled The End of New Deal Liberalism, which was published in the January 5th edition of the Nation magazine. And maybe you could just briefly discuss the programs put in place during the Great Depression and how you think that intersects with Dr. Martin Luther King's life as you know, he lurks in the background here in our discussion.
That's a wonderful frame, because the New Deal, like all important human endeavors, was not perfect and did not succeed in every dimension. But it did create a new framework for American politics and government. It was essentially, to make it very, very simple, government will be the trustworthy agent of the society, of people. And it will create some protections and obligations that the private sphere of economic enterprise, whether you're talking about banks or big corporations, must observe. In that context, they advance social desires, aspirations that had existed for really more than 100 years earlier, and fulfilled a lot of things, some very basic. Dr. King came along as a heroic public leader, really 30 years later, and said, "We are incomplete for reasons everybody knows. We have not yet acknowledged the great divide between white and black, and the way in large parts of the country, if not all of the country, African Americans are still treated as secondary citizens, and we intend to change that." And I think you make me consider this. So the piece that comes into my mind immediately is, in very different ways, FDR, the New Deal, and all of the liberals who joined that cause, including what I was saying in that piece in The Nation is that the legacy of FDR, Harry Truman, LBJ, Lyndon Johnson has pretty much been closed out in the last 2 years. And I'm not saying that to disparage our current president, but I am suggesting that the Democratic Party inherited that ideal, and in the face of an epic crisis, it refused to use the government's extensive powers in the last 2 years, both to correct the economic disorders, but also to heal the society. And I guess to a lot of people that will sound overly harsh. I'm afraid I think the facts support it.
Thank you for that, William Grider. As your article discusses the end of New Deal liberalism, for decades the Republican Party and conservative mission in the country has been to dismantle the New Deal programs, and that includes proposed deep cuts in social spending and deregulation of corporations, and some very specific attacks on vaunted programs like Social Security and Medicare. What's been the Democrats' response and President Obama's response to this culmination of many years' worth of attempts to undermine these programs?
Well, Obama, I think, with utter sincerity, would like to sort of work things out across the ideological and party divides. And I don't doubt that he is sincere about that, but it's so out of step with the enormity of what we are facing that that you begin to question the sincerity. I think the Democrats, having for many years sustained the idea that we still believe in those things, in social justice, in equity, in protecting the weak and the innocent from the depredations of big business or big banks or whoever, they could say that with great clarity when they were out of power, and they did. And so many of us could say, well, it's not fair to judge them because they're now lack the ability to do anything about these aggravations and afflictions, and so withhold judgment. And now, in the last 2 years, judgment has arrived, at least for me, and I think others, where we saw them repeatedly decline to assert the powers of government to correct these things, and indeed even to try to work out deals with the sectors of the economy that were responsible. The most visible but dramatic one is banking and finance, who everybody understands caused this calamity and the collapse and huge losses and great dislocations. The government, starting with George W. Bush, but then continuing under Obama, basically makes them well. And that's first on the agenda. Let's get the banks out of their problems. And that may indeed have been an imperative, but they didn't ask for anything in return or demand anything in return, which is what a new dealer would do. The new dealer would say, okay, we're gonna get you out of the ditch and make you well, and here's what we're going to require in return. Deal with the foreclosures. Drop all of the sort of nonsense of funny money deal-making you do with hedge funds and the shadow banking committee. I mean, it's a long list, right? And that, and also I would add on the health care reform, there was a serious reluctance to change the health care system in structural ways, that is, fundamental ways. And so a lot of us have a deep suspicion that whatever the good intentions, this isn't going to cure the problem. They made deals with the pharmaceutical industry, with the health insurance industry, and with a bunch of others, which maybe look rational to the deal makers, but actually don't get at the problem. So that's the center of my disappointment, and I think our complaints will be tested in the next few years, whether or not things were actually changed. And I'm afraid the answer is not much.
William Greider is our guest tonight, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine. We're talking about his article, The End of New Deal Liberalism, appearing in the January 5th edition of The Nation magazine. And Mr. Greider, we've seen President Obama from the White House negotiate an extension of the tax cuts for the wealthiest sectors of society. And at the same time, he handpicked a deficit commission that mostly agree, whatever party they belong to, they mostly agree on cutbacks in Social Security, raising the eligibility age, and reductions in Medicare benefits. What is the signal in terms of what's going to happen in the next year or so when this new Republican Congress is going to drive as hard as they can to undercut Social Security and these other social programs in confluence with what seems to be a similar agenda from the White House?
Well, that's part of my judgment, my harsh judgment about the Democratic Party, that Republicans have a kind of inherited dread and distaste for Social Security, even though it's basically a very conservative idea. It's a national system of social insurance. Every working person contributes to it every week in their paycheck, and it guarantees that they will not be left destitute if in old age, or if they're disabled, or if calamity occurs in their sector and they're unemployed for long periods of time. There's nothing very radical in that. It's been existed in advanced industrial countries around the world for well over 100 years. But now, for lots of reasons, which I find quite fraudulent, they are deciding is the time we must correct Social Security, which is a nice way of saying we're going to whack the benefits for future retirees, and for the long-term fiscal solvency of the country. And I could go through in some detail and explain to people why that's bogus. But for our discussion, the meaningful thing is that the Republican position has been well known for 80 years, and they're unrelenting. They hate Social Security. They hated it when it was created, and they've hated it actively ever since. The shock is the Democratic position. We have a Democratic president now who is saying, well, let's sit down and talk about this. We can work something out. And that puts a lot of us right on at battle stations, because Republicans might actually succeed in disabling Social Security and ultimately destroying it if the Democrats cooperate with that. And there's a lot of nervousness in Washington right now among people like myself and others who are active in the political system, that the president in his State of the Union may announce some grand prospect for compromise on Social Security and Medicare. I hope that gossip is wrong, but I know people have been to the White House to express their alarm, and were not entirely reassured by the answer they got from the president's staff. So we'll see. I think it's disastrous if he gives in to that crusade. That's part of why I say it's the end of the New Deal, if that's what is about to unfold. The moral logic of our situation is turned upside down by both political parties, in a sense. We know who the culprits were in this crisis. We know pretty well clearly how the seeds were sown for a financial disaster. We know who the victims are, and they're not it's just the broad middle class, to put it mildly. Anybody who suffered from the collapsing job market, but also their financial assets lost horrendously as the stock market collapsed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet they are now being told they have to suck it up and pay the price to some extent for the disaster caused by others, who the financial titans and to some extent the multinational moguls who played along with that. I mean, you don't have to be an economist to understand the injustice of that. and I think it reflects the great divide in our political system, which is not really Democrats versus Republicans so much as it is the governing elites in both parties versus the broad ranks of citizens. And I try to explain that in my Nation piece. I've been writing that for some years, but with the hope that the Democratic Party in a meaningful crisis would prove me wrong. And that's why I'm reaching a harsh judgment now.
William Grider, there was a recent poll that talked about nationally people's preference for taxing the rich and cutting back on Pentagon spending rather than cutting back on Social Security or Medicare benefits. And I wonder, as you look around the country now, you've got angry Tea Party folks on the right, you've got a left that's quite disorganized and dispirited, I would say myself. Do you see any hope that people will say enough at some point with compromises to the right and the corporate agenda, and that people will rise up, labor unions, working folks, and say, we've had it. We're not going to take this land down, and that Social Security is going to be the big demarcating fight that will really be that really could be a turning point for the country's politics.
Yeah, I think that is possible. I won't say more than that, and obviously you've read my piece. That my hope hangs on that thread, that will indeed happen, and I think there's a good basis for believing in the possibility. And you know, one of my small roles is to sort of stand on the creased corner, urging people to throw off the cynicism and the resignation and all the rest, and throw off especially the propaganda of mass media, and take responsibility for the country, for themselves, for their futures. And that sounds like a hopeless message, I know, to a lot of people, but if you look back, and Dr. King is relevant here, in the long run, in our history as Americans, that is the only thing that has produced a really fundamental change. And I cite the civil rights movement, which I covered as a young reporter really 4 or 5 decades ago, in awe, because I was being educated by it along with millions of other white Americans. And I spent some time in small towns across the South and was at some of the bigger, more dramatic events. But what really got to me was sitting in a church basement or elsewhere where very humble people were discussing their oppression. And a few preachers and some, maybe a political leader or two among them, but basically the people themselves worked up their courage to march down to the courthouse the next day, or to march on the schools that were then segregated, and really literally put their life on the line for the change and liberation. And you can't almost at anywhere along that story say, well, they knew by then they were going to prevail. That was never true. That was never true. So I offer to people today, if this sounds pointless and impossible, imagine those earlier Americans in much more extreme circumstances who gambled their personal well-being by standing up and acting. And I literally think we're now at a profound turning point in the history of America. And we've discussed a couple of aspects of it, but there are many more. It's the war. We're fighting wars all over the world while we're borrowing the money to do so. The ecological damage has now reached a stage where people can see concretely the destruction that lies ahead if they don't change things. The searing inequality in our society, which has developed over the last 30 years, thanks to that right-wing doctrine of everybody for themselves, never mind the society. I can go on. You know the list, probably. But in that situation, I think in my last book I argued the only thing that can pull us out of what we're in now is a popular mobilization. And let me add one more stroke to that. What gives me considerable hope that it will arise and can succeed is that, contrary to what you read in the newspapers or see on television, I actually think most Americans are united on some very basic principles. Even I would include the Tea Party crowd. That's not to say we all agree on everything. Obviously, we don't. But if you take fundamentals, what they want is not that different from what a lot of liberals and labor people and left-wingers want, which is a government that's responsive to the people, not to the big money. And how do you get that? Well, then we'll have some arguments. But Social Security, for instance. The Wall Street Journal had a poll a couple months ago and asked, and we're kind of taken aback to see that the public overwhelmingly supports defense of Social Security. Don't cut benefits. That's the last thing you should do in these circumstances. And guess what? The Tea Party crowd has even stronger views, like some 65% say don't tamper with Social Security. So that's the basis for my hope, and I think it doesn't matter basically what I think one way or the other. It only matters if people themselves, people well off, people not so well off, people poor, find a way to come together and make themselves heard.
Thank you so much for spending time with us tonight, William Grider, talking about this important topic. And again, the article is The End of New Deal Liberalism, appearing in the January 5th edition of The Nation magazine. And I think it goes without saying there's a tough fight ahead given the Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case, which gives corporations, labor unions too, but certainly corporations have the money to spend as much as they want in election campaigns. So there's a lot of money to fight here with people.
Let me just plug in there those are hard facts, and they're part of the reality we're up against. On the other hand, again, I go back to earlier times, whether it's the civil rights movement 50, 60 years ago, or the populace 100 years ago, and abolitionists before that. Citizens today, even very humble citizens, are well equipped and have resources that none of those earlier movements had. And yet somehow they got their act together and marched, and ultimately, after some bloodshed and disappointments, they prevailed. So, yes, it's a hard fight, but that doesn't mean it ought not to be fought.
Definitely not. And thanks for the inspiration. And certainly, just as another thought here, we can look to Europe and see that there is resistance in the streets across European cities to the cutbacks and the austerity plans that are being tried out there. And certainly, I think we see a similar fight developing here in the U.S.
Yeah, and I think there are lots of bonfires around the country that don't get headlines. They've not yet turned into the big parade, as they have in some of those European countries, but I would say to those in power, don't count it out, because I think that's coming.
And I like very much your line in the recent article where you talk about history is a very unpredictable thing, and as we've seen time and again, when the status quo looks like it's going to prevail, people have a way of mucking that up.
Yeah, that's what I hope for.
Well, thank you so much, William Grider. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. William Grider, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine, and his article again, The End of New Deal Liberalism, January 5th edition of The Nation. And you can read that online at thenation.com.